From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is a Tales from the South Tin Roof Project.
Family folklore includes English, Irish, French, Spanish, and Native American, in addition to African and all sides of my all-American heritage stew.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
Another time, after I'd published an article in Essence Magazine, another writer friend asked, "Did I know you were black?" How do you answer a question like that? Yes.
This week, it's an intimate dinner with a notable Southerner on our unrehearsed show, telling their story as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
We were halfway through our first date when I discovered he wasn't black, and he discovered I wasn't white.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
It's me to start thinking, well, this honky-tonk living is gonna drive me to drinking. Oh, this honky-tonk living drive me to drinking.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late bluesman Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. He wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? A Pine Bluff, Arkansas native, Laura Parker Castoro is a national best-selling author with 39 books published in the U.S. Her work has also been published in 15 foreign languages, including, among others, German, French, Italian, Russian, Icelandic, Hungarian, Chinese, and Japanese. She began her career writing historical and contemporary romance. She went on to write novels in other genres, Western, saga, romantic suspense, young adult nonfiction, African American, and mainstream. And recent novels include humorous looks at the contemporary life, loves, and trials of women of a certain age. Her publishers have included Warner, Pocket Books, Avon, Simon & Schuster, Dell, Harlequin Intrigue, Silhouette Intimate Moments and Silhouette Special Edition, Kensington, Berkeley, Red Dress, Inc., Mira, and HarperCollins Avon A-Plus Trade. She has also published work for magazines and newspapers, including Good Housekeeping Magazine. Laura is a much sought-after lecturer on topics related to the craft of writing and the demands of getting published. She also appears as a guest or featured speaker at numerous other types of programs and meetings throughout the U.S. She teaches creative writing classes, as well as 1- and 2-day commercial fiction and marketing workshops. In 2005, she was inducted into the Arkansas Writers Hall of Fame and she is past president and currently a board member of the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow. The Denise Marcel Literary Agency of New York City represents her. Laura lives and writes in Pine Bluff, which is also my hometown. She and her husband have 3 children. Tonight, Laura takes us to a dinner party where her superpowers are once again put to the test in Invisible Sister. Ladies and gentlemen, Laura Parker Castoro.
I have a superpower, sort of. I can be invisible. Invisible sometimes stinks. Do you want to leave? My husband's face was tense with concern. I shrugged, trying to decide. Our host was my husband's business associate as well as friend, and I didn't want to put him on the spot. But one of the guests had had me on edge for the entire night. As he drank a lot, he talked a lot. He soon proved that he was an equal opportunity bigot. It didn't take him long to insult every race, creed, religious, and political leaning. I'm Southern, and I was taught to be polite when you're a guest. So I gritted my teeth whenever I heard his voice and tried to avoid speaking to him directly. As my grandmother liked to say, you can't right every wrong. If a dog leaves doo-doo in the street, step around it and keep walking. I shook my head and swallowed the last of my drink. But as the heat of that Jack Daniels hit my stomach, I looked up to see the man coming straight toward me. He was smiling as he stopped before me. I hear you're a best-selling author. That's just what I've been saying. White Americans are on top of the heap in every field, and that's just where we belong. There it was, the doo-doo on my doorstep. No way to avoid it this time. I felt the flush rush up into my face. My husband's hand moved to the small of my back for support. Suddenly, there was less conversation around us because a few of the guests knew something he did not. I smiled tightly. You can't mean we deserve everything that we have simply because we are white. Yes, I do, he boasted. You're successful because you're superior. I had him. Yes, like you, I am successful, and I've earned my success through education and hard work just like you. But I'm African American. The bewildered man's head jerked toward my husband. Did she say she's black? He nodded. The man started, she doesn't look it. Chris smiled, she can't help it. Yes, I'm African American and I don't look it. That shouldn't be of much consequence these days. No, that's a lie. How I look has always been of consequence. From the beginning, it helped shape my life. Back in the late 1950s segregated South, visitors came to my elementary school on the campus of the historic Black AM&N College in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. One visitor spied me and remarked in surprise, oh, you're integrated. She may be forgiven her mistake. I was born blonde with green eyes and freckles, and I burn more readily than tan. Yet, I'm colored, as my birth certificate says. I grew up in Pine Bluff, where generations of my father's family could track their lineage right back to the names and faces of slavery. Just for the record, both my parents are African American, and all 4 of my grandparents. Before that, things get a little complicated, as they often do in the South. Family folklore includes English, Irish, French, Spanish, and Native American, in addition to African in all sides of my all-American heritage stew. I knew I was much lighter than my friends, but I thought it must be obvious to others what I was. Everyone knew me as Dr. Parker's daughter. My mother was a teacher and my father was a dentist. He was also a social activist and one-time president of the Arkansas NAACP. My brothers and I went to Negro schools, attended Negro churches, and we bought our food and gasoline at Negro-owned businesses. Whites were seldom part of my daily life. Then desegregation came along and things changed. By patronizing places formerly closed to Negroes, such as the main floor of the Sanger Theater or the soda fountain at Woolworths, I went from being invisible to conspicuous. People would stare at me uncomprehendingly when I was with my friends, and sometimes they did more. Once while walking home from my still segregated high school with a male friend, some white boys stopped their car, jumped out, and started shouting obscenities at my friend and telling him to get away from, quote, that white girl. Luckily, other friends came running and they drove off. Another time, my date and I were stopped by a policeman who demanded to know what we were doing together. I explained who I was, but it didn't matter. He said people would only see what it looked like. And then he told my date to take me home and leave me there, that he didn't want any trouble on his beat. Years later, a guy I had liked back in high school told me he hadn't asked me out because he didn't want to deal with whites who might cause us trouble. So that's what put a crimp in my love life. In the late 1960s, I left for college, Howard University in Washington, D.C., another historic black college. I was certain that there I would go back to being invisible. But those were the days of black power, and a kind of reverse prejudice was in full bloom. I was too pale to be easily identified. I couldn't grow an afro. I wasn't a militant. The day after Martin Luther King was shot, I was barred from a meeting in my honors dorm about the tragedy because I was told by a girl I considered a friend I wasn't really black. I was hurt and insulted. She'd borrowed my clothes and dated a friend. The bitter irony was I was being dumped on because I looked like the oppressor. I met my husband at Howard University. He's second-generation Italian-American, and to tell you the truth, we profiled one another when we first met. We were halfway through our first date when I discovered he wasn't black, and he discovered I wasn't white. Turned out it wasn't a deal-breaker. Marrying Chris did plunge me for the first time into the white world. It was only then that I fully understood how truly invisible I could be to strangers, black and white. No one suspected that the blushing bride with the blonde bangs who had arrived in South Texas was anything else but a WASP. A queasy feeling came over me. I was unintentionally passing in every encounter in my new world. It struck me for the first time in my life, I was going to have to tell everybody what wasn't obvious, or live with the consequences. In doing so, I became sort of a Rorschach test for people's attitudes about race and color. In the beginning, every admission was a dive off the high board. Few were comfortable with my designation, and I wasn't always comfortable with their reaction. A Texas Ranger told my husband that it would be safer if I checked the white box on my driver's license. A census taker in Connecticut argued with me about my response to the "what are you" question. Yet there were moments better not to speak up. There was the time that two young men knocked on my door from a religious group that until recently proclaimed very negative attitudes about certain people of color. Their testimony of faith quickly became a discussion of sinners and the damned. They said that people of African descent were Satan's spawn. One of those creamy-faced young men launched into a tale he'd heard from a missionary to Africa about the abomination created by mixing the races. He said that I had to be careful because some of those damned souls were, quote, as pale as you and me. I leaned into him, seriously? They look just like you and me? He nodded solemnly, white as you and me, but there's a way to tell. For instance, they're ugly. And their skin is mottled like a piebald horse with black spotches that mark their white skin. I see. After a few moments, I sent them on their way. And once the door was closed, I laughed myself silly. They couldn't detect me. Something else I discovered. Even people who'd known for years that I'm African American would forget after a while because there's no visual cues to keep reminding them. Once after I'd read a scene from a book in progress in a writer's group, a colleague came up and said, quote, "I'm really impressed with your ability to write about characters so unlike you. You perfectly captured those black people. How did you do that?" I decided to tell the real truth. I pay attention, which is true on so many levels. Another time, after I'd published an article in Essence magazine, another writer friend asked, "Did I know you were black?" How do you answer a question like that? Yes. That same night, another friend apologized if he'd ever said anything that offended me. I said he hadn't, but wondered what had he thought that he hadn't said. Uh-oh, now I'm trying to read people's minds. It was all too much. My superpower, invisibility, had become a burden. So then I had to wonder, what do I owe the world? Why do people need to know who I am? So they aren't embarrassed? Maybe I should wear a tee that says, "Woman in shirt is blacker than she appears." Then the memory of a family saying came back to me, "Don't let someone's crazy make you crazy." Aha. So when a white romance writer friend showed me her new book cover and confided that she was worried because the hero was so swarthy, she was afraid that her readers would think she'd written an interracial romance, which she was totally against. I decided to tell it like it is. I'm in an interracial romance, Betty, remember? She looked puzzled and then embarrassed. Oh, I didn't mean you. We remained friends. Her crazy, not mine. Let me add that prejudice is not just a one-way street. I've been snubbed and ignored and been made the butt of rude comments by blacks who thought I was white. And then there's always that black acquaintance who can't find me in a mixed group and says, "Oh girl, I thought you were white." The world has changed so much since I was a child, a teen, a newlywed. Chris and I have become parents and reared three biracial children. So as I stood watching the bigot, trying to process that the green-eyed, blonde, freckle woman in front of him was black, I felt the familiar sting of prejudice and vulnerability, but also a swelling of pride. Looking like me has given me a unique opportunity to view the world from both sides, what I am and what I look like. I've learned that what you see isn't necessarily what's there, or what's true, or all there is. My superpower might not allow me to soar, or climb buildings, or lift mountains, but it's a God-given gift of insight that most people, including that bigot, will never know. I'm a white-looking black woman. That's what I am. It's not who I am, and it's certainly not all that I am.
So thank you so much, Laura Parker Castoro, for being on Tales from the South. You say in your story that you were halfway through your first date with your future husband, Chris, when you discovered he wasn't black and he learned you weren't white. So can you tell us more? Like, how did that conversation go?
I was trying to think about that. I had been taking German, and he was making an A, and I was making a C, and I needed help to keep that scholarship I had. And so he'd been tutoring me, and I finally asked him out to a party that I had been invited to. And he said, okay. And so we went, and we're at the party, and some of the people knew each other really well. We didn't know each other so well, so we got to talking. And he said that I pulled out some pictures of from my album, and I showed him my mother and my father, and I was talking about, and he said he looked at my dad and thought, He'd been at Howard for 2 years before I got there, so he knew a lot about black people. And he said, so, you're not white, are you? And I said, no. And he said, well, I'm Italian-American. I said, oh, well, there's some French and English. And so he said, no, I'm all Italian-American. And I thought, oh, my goodness, what's this little black girl from the South doing with a white guy? Oh, my goodness. So we were polite, but we sort of kind of, you know, the evening was nicely over. And I thought, well, that's that. And then a couple of weeks later, he invited me out to dinner. So since he was the second date and on his terms, I decided that, we'd see how far this would go.
How about the census taker in Connecticut? I'm interested in that story. This is the one who argued with her about her response to the what are you question, actually argued. How did that encounter end up?
Well, the census taker had come to our door. They occasionally send people out to knock on doors and actually do the interviews one-on-one instead of mailing it back. And we had been through how many people in the household, was the income, all this kind of stuff. And she said, I just have one or two more questions. And one of them is, how many ethnic groups or whatever are in your family? And I said, well, my husband's Italian-American and I'm African-American. She stopped. She looked at me. She wagged her finger and said, oh, no, you're not. And I said, oh, yes, I am. And she said, well, we were just supposed to observe anyway. And I said, you can observe anything you want, but that's the truth.
I love your grandmother saying that was at the beginning of the story, you can't right every wrong. If a dog leaves doo-doo in the street, just step around it and keep going. So did she have other words of wisdom that you remembered over the years?
I do. One of her favorite when I was a kid and things would happen was consider the source.
Oh, yes.
You've heard that before, yes. And that was about, you know, think about it. I come home and somebody called me a big old JoJo blah, blah, blah. And she said, well, are you a big old JoJo blah, blah, blah? I was like, no. Well, where did it come from? He didn't like me. Well, what did you expect? And it was helpful as I got older, too, because it makes you stop and think sometime when you get very upset about things. Well, is that person right? Is this somebody whose opinion you care about? And so it's been helpful all through my life. Another thing, and my mother said this, was if you can't be first, be different. And it was about not envying what other people have, that you have something of your own. Become your own person, and don't worry about what other people have. So I would say that has translated into the worst thing a salesperson can say to me is, oh, that's so popular. We've sold lots of those. I will not buy it. I wasn't first. I'm going to be different. And one of the other family things that came from my grandmother's side of the family, this is about marriage and relationships when you're thinking about getting married. And she would say, don't bring home stupid and don't bring home ugly. But don't bring home stupid.
Wise words, right? Well, good. Well, we have a few minutes here left at the end. The audience can ask questions. You can ask Laura whatever you would like to ask her.
My oldest sister, I'm from a family of eight. I'm the seventh of eight. I'm white and Cajun and very Southern. But she looked black, and she's married to a black man. You know, years later, when I kind of grew up and I moved here to Little Rock and she was living here, she was really embedded in the black community. And when they met me, they realized she was white and she looked black. I was wondering what you thought about from the other perspective of someone growing up white who looked black.
My family, we are the original Rainbow Coalition. We just we run the gamut of all colors and all sizes and everything. And I never really thought that much about it because I grew up with uncles, aunts, cousins, everybody, you know, who we didn't all look exactly the same. And so that's why I thought, okay, I'm the lightest end of this, but I'm a continuum, you know. And so it was not. I think there are lots of people who feel out of place within their own families for all kinds of reasons. I was signing a book once, and a lady came up to me, and I had been talking about this kind of thing, and she said, you know, I'm the only brown-eyed person in my family. I have brothers and sisters. They're blue-eyed. Both my parents are blue-eyed. And kids teased me all my life and said, you must be adopted or your mama was running around. And so she said, it wasn't until I was 20-something years old and I saw a picture of my great-grandmother, I think she said, and I looked just like her. And finally, I felt like I belonged. So I think that the American population is more diverse than we give ourselves credit for. We don't know all what all of our roots are. Who knows? And it's fascinating, and it's interesting, and people are now seeking it out. We can do all kinds of things with DNA and that kind of stuff. So I think it helps to make us understand that we are more alike than we are different. I think that's the big thing.
I'm from Pine Bluff, too. I seem to recall on Main Street, north of the railroad tracks, the main railroad tracks that went through, the east side was more populated by the African-American community, and the west side was more of the white people. And I was just wondering, did you ever feel as though that I could pass if I just crossed the street?
Yes, my dad's office was at 4th and Main, so I know exactly what you were talking about. I grew up in the black community. My family was black, and my father made that clear. My parents made that clear early on. I grew up in the age of agitation for integration. As I said, my father was state president of the NAACP, so we were deeply involved. And it wasn't a matter of what color you were. It was a matter of right and wrong. And so you couldn't make decisions based on, well, you're a little bit lighter or you're a little this or that. It was wrong to have desegregation against people, period. And so the color issue was not an issue. We were all the same. You had to think in those terms. And so the idea of passing never crossed my mind. I think a lot of people thought it must have crossed my mind. I've been asked that question a lot. But like I said, my parents gave me a firm, and my brothers, a firm footing where we were and where we belonged, and that it was okay to be here, and it was okay to be over there on that other side, too, because everybody was the same. And so I never had the sense that, well, it would be easier. Not easier for me. I had family. I wasn't going to give up my family for anybody. So I had to make, you know, some of these decisions about who do you tell and how do you tell and all of that. But it was never, maybe this, I'll just forget about this. Didn't come up for me.
So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, Laura Parker Castoro, for being on our Tin Roof Project here on Tales from the South. More can be found out about Laura at lauracastoro.com. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, with additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.